You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Jeffrey Renaud Allen's latest novel, Song of the Shank, reimagines the life and career of Thomas Wiggins, a 19th century African-American piano virtuoso who, despite having been born into slavery, performed internationally for years under the stage name Blind Tom. The book's been receiving sensational reviews. Mitchell Jackson described it in a front-page review in the July 19th New York Times Book Review as an imaginative work only a prodigiously gifted risk-taker could produce. This is Jeff Allen's second novel. He's also published a short story collection and two volumes of poetry. Song of the Shank is published by Grey Wolf Press, and I'm very pleased it brings Mr. Allen to our show today. Hello.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
The reviews I just mentioned also have compared your writing to Ralph Ellison, William Faulkner, Toni Morrison. Are they influences?
Well, they are certainly influences. I mean, I always say that I come from the line of Faulkner. You know, I've read his work for many years and constantly go back to it. And, you know, I certainly love Whiteman, John Edgar Whiteman, Toni Morrison, and many other writers. But I think, you know, you try to learn from the various people you love and develop your own voice. So I would like to think that my voice is my own.
Although there are a number of voices in this book, which we'll get to.
That's true.
Isn't this based on a real person named Thomas Wiggins, who was known as Blind Tom? How did you come upon his story?
Well, I came upon his story by accident, really. I guess in 1998, I happened to be reading Oliver Sacks' book, An Anthropologist on Mars, you know, which talks, of course, about unusual neurological disorders. And in one chapter, he talks about savantism and talks about Tom as a historical example of one. So that's where I really first heard about his story.
If he were born today, would he be called an autistic idiosavant?
Well, for sure. I mean, in his own time, he was, of course, called an idiot savant. And Sacks himself believes that Tom was an autistic savant.
People also thought he was mentally deficient at the time.
They did, yes.
Despite his brilliance.
Right. So, I mean, I think what's interesting, really, one of the interesting things for me is, you know, trying to sort through those kinds of medical questions and those kinds of racial issues, you know. I mean, a lot of the commentary about Tom was certainly colored by the racist discourse of the time.
Although he's been largely forgotten, wasn't he one of the best-known performers of his time?
Yeah, in fact, according to at least one person, one biography of him, he was the most famous pianist of the 19th century, you know, and really had a very well-received career from the 1850s until the late 1880s.
Where was he born?
He was born in Columbus, Georgia.
And then he and his parents were purchased by General James Bethune.
That's true.
He was a plantation owner, had a plantation called 100 Gates, but also was a lawyer and a newspaper publisher. And wasn't General Bethune also an early proponent of Southern secession?
He was, yes. So actually, as far as I know, General Bethune was not a plantation owner. That 100 Gates is my own invention in the novel.
Oh.
So that's not a historical fact.
This is always a problem when you're reading a book that's kind of based on history.
Well, he was actually a newspaper man and, as you mentioned, an early advocate of secession. Yes, indeed.
But he was a slave owner.
He was a slave owner. And one of the ironies, of course, is that he certainly owned Tom. And while he owned Tom, you know, the Civil War, of course, erupted, and Tom had the dubious cause of having to give benefit concerts for the Confederates, you know.
And when he performed before the war, I'm assuming that the only people who heard him were whites.
Indeed, yes. I mean, the audience, I think it's important to remember that Blind Tom had primarily a classical repertoire. He didn't play, you know, Negro folk songs and such of the era. And unlike most other Negro musicians, he didn't play the banjo or the violin, which were the two common instruments. So here was a Negro pianist who played classical music and had a classical repertoire. But, you know, that being said, I mean, he was certainly admired by, you know, many, many black people, yes.
In your telling, because of his limitations, Tom was excused from working on the plantation, which what didn't exist, actually, and allowed to amuse himself however he wanted. Is that how Tom and the people around him first recognized his exceptional musical abilities?
Right. I mean, it's, of course, hard to decipher fact from fiction, from mythology here, but the story goes that General Bethune's wife was a piano teacher, and there was a piano in their home. And the story goes that when Tom was about 2 years old, he crawled over to the piano and started playing one of the songs that he had just heard. So the wife recognized his talents musically. And then when Tom was about six, he began to give public concert recitals.
And he even performed at the White House for President James Buchanan when he was 10 years old.
That's true. He was the first African-American, in fact, to perform at the White House, yes.
Didn't he also play for Willa Cather, Mark Twain, and others? Did they write about him?
Right. Well, he didn't play for Willa Cather. When Willa Cather was a student in college in Nebraska, she saw him perform, and she wrote a review of his performance. But
what did she say?
She didn't like his playing, actually. She called him a human music box, you know, so which wasn't very nice. But, you know, most people who saw him, though, really found him to be an amazing player. So I think that's kind of one of the things that drew me to his story is the fact that many people, when they went to see him perform, thought that they were in the presence of something supernatural. So, you know, in fact, Twain, who you just mentioned, Twain said something like, you know, Tom's powers either come from God or the devil, you know. So it was hard for even the most well-intentioned people like Mark Twain to imagine that a black person then could actually have musical genius.
Well, Tom wasn't the only idiot savant in the 19th century.
Right.
And there were other musical geniuses who or people who could tell you what day any date was.
Right, right. Well, I mean, that's the question, though. You know, was Tom a savant or was he simply a musical genius? You know, and I think that's really the issue because a person...
Well, he was blind, so that complicates the story.
That complicates the story even more, right. So I think generally people, when we talk about savantism, we think of people who have no true creativity. And if there's no true creativity, then there's really no interest for music people to study them. However, if, you know, Tom, in fact, was, you know, the black Mozart, or which is what one of his biographers believes, you know, then, you know, why is it that Tom has been erased from history, right? So the label of the idiot savant or the label of the autistic savant, I think has led to his dismissal from serious consideration by music critics.
My guest is Jeffrey Renard Allen. His latest novel, Song of the Shank. He had an incredible memory, obviously. He was blind, so he couldn't read music,
yes,
but was able to play complex pieces of music perfectly from hearing them only once. And at the height of his career, it was reported he knew some 7,000 pieces of music by heart.
Indeed.
But memory wouldn't explain his ability to compose new music.
Exactly.
How many new pieces did he compose? Were they like classical music?
Yes. So as far as I know, he composed about 500 songs, which were, you know, popular sellers as sheet music.
So, do they still exist?
They do. I mean, you can certainly find some of them, and you can even find some of them online. But as to my knowledge, they've never been collected or cataloged in the way that many others people's music has. But I think what's interesting too, and this is another thing that drew me to his story and made me want to write a novel about him, is that he had this other category of song which was, you know, totally unclassifiable in terms of his own time. So that is to say, he would do songs in imitation of man-made and natural phenomena. So he had a song called, you know, Rainstorm. He had another song called Sewing, which apparently he attempted to imitate the sound of the sewing machine on the piano. So he had these sorts of songs. And then also as part of this performance, his stage performance, which was billed as the Blind Tom Exhibition, he certainly gave these recitals of memory that you've mentioned, but he would do things like play three songs at once. So he could play one song with his left hand and
this
one
is
key.
Russ on Roland Kirk before, and
right,
he was
exactly.
also blind, by the way.
That's exactly what I was thinking, you know. So this is Russ on Roland Kirk, you know, who could play three saxophones at once and who could play a flute with his nose, you know. So Blind Tom, you know, did those. He was doing these kinds of things in the 19th century.
What happened after the war? He was no longer a slave.
He was no longer a slave, but here's what's interesting. So, you know, most of the characters in my novel are based on real people, and the events are kind of my exaggeration of some of these real things that happened. So what's interesting is that General Bethune entered into a business arrangement with a man named Tabs Gross, and that was his actual name, Tabs Gross, who was black entrepreneur, an African-American entrepreneur from Cincinnati. So the general reneged on the business agreement, and Tabs Gross sued General Bethune in a court in Cincinnati. And interestingly enough, the court ruled that because Blind Tom, or Thomas Wiggins, was a mental incompetent, that General Bethune should be his legal guardian. So essentially, Tom was re-enslaved, you know, after emancipation.
And you tell Tom's story from the perspectives of the people around him, like General Bethune, also Eliza Bethune, the general's daughter-in-law and Tom's final caretaker.
Yes.
Perry Oliver, his manager, Charity, his mother. Was it challenging to find voices for such a diverse group of characters?
Yeah, but, you know, as far as how
also 19th century voices.
Right. That was, well, the real challenge in the book. I mean, I guess I think of myself as a person who's very interested in interiority and how people think on the inside, you know. So the biggest challenge for me actually was really, you know, finding out how black people actually spoke in New York City in the 19th century, since, you know, New York City is at that time is one of the central locations of the book.
Although you don't call it New York City.
I don't call it New York City. I call it the city. Right. So it was, you know, I'm very good at dialogue and I can do contemporary dialogue, you know, like falling off a log. It's easy for me.
But you don't use quotes when you do dialogue.
No, that's something I just love to do because I like the idea that the narration and the dialogue can become kind of one voice and flow together.
You've chosen not to tell a story from Tom's perspective, unlike Faulkner, who created Benji.
Yes.
But Tom is largely nonverbal. Sometimes he does say things that could be interpreted as brilliant or insightful. Did you want the reader to think of Tom as a genius oblivious to everything that was going on around him?
No, quite the contrary, in fact. What I wanted to do was to make Tom into a concrete character, but keep him mysterious at the same time. So in one of the earlier drafts of the novel, I actually had an entire section that was from his point of view. And I realized that what that section did is it had destroyed everything that I had already accomplished earlier in the book. And so, you know, I think it's important that, you know, Tom was certainly in real life and in my novel, he was certainly victimized. But I think you'll find in the novel also, he's a very difficult person on many levels. And in his difficulty, there is some kind of force and resistance. There's some power in that, you know, and there's also, of course, power in his music. And there are power, you know, various kinds of powers in the things that he says, the very few things that he says, which actually some of those things were invented. Some of those things I found in actual historical record, and some of those things are really crazy allusions, you know, to Shakespeare and all kinds of stuff, you know.
You don't tell the story chronologically. You move back and forth in time, shifting between the periods before and after the Civil War. In his rave review in the current issue of Book Forum, Gene Seymour described this as an eerie fever dream of a historical novel.
Yes, I like that phrase.
I understand that you worked on this book for almost 10 years. Did you have any idea that it was going to take you so long when you began?
No, and I'm sure if I had, maybe I would have stopped writing. No.
But knowing that you're going to get the kind of response you've gotten, maybe it was worth all the effort.
I would think so. I mean, I think you do it because you like to do it. You do it because you have to. And I didn't have any idea it would take this long, of course, but you keep at it until you get it right, and that's what I try to do.
If I didn't already know that you were a poet, I might have guessed it from the way you've written this novel. Did it sound like this from the first draft?
Well, no, not exactly, because when I first started the book, I had a different chronology in mind. So it starts with the earlier draft started with the Perry Oliver character in the 1850s. And in that particular section of the novel, I try to write in imitation of a kind of 19th century narration. So the language there was very pared down, as opposed to the kind of poetic passages that happen later.
Do you shift back and forth between writing poetry and fiction?
Well, I haven't done much shifting of late because it took me 10 years on this one.
So, you didn't write any poems in between, just during the down periods?
I think I may have done one or so, but not many. But, you know, truth to tell, I don't know if I still consider myself a poet. You know, this is I came to poetry because, you know, I started out as a fiction writer. But once, when I was in graduate school, we had a visiting writer who read one of my stories and told me that the language was essentially bland, you know, in so many words. And I didn't want to be thought of as a fiction writer who had bland language. So I started actually reading, or not reading, I was already reading poetry, but I started reading poetry more seriously. And I started writing poetry as a way to learn how to use language.
You know? You teach at Queens College and in the writing program at the New School.
Yes.
Are you teaching fiction?
At the New School, I teach in the writing program where I teach fiction. In the fall, I do a semester that focuses essentially on kinds of experiments in narrative over the last 100 years. And at Queens College, I teach primarily undergraduate literature courses.
I'm assuming you've already started on another work?
I haven't quite started, but it's in my mind. The next book will be about John Baptiste Dusable. It's a novel that's a jump off on him. Some of you may know that John Baptiste Dusable was the black man who founded Chicago. So I'm going to take his story and take it into some interesting directions.
Just one more thing before you go. Where does the title Song of the Shank come from?
Oh, I don't know where it comes from, but it obviously has many meanings. No, actually, originally it was the title of a poem that written. And a friend of mine said, well, you know, that's too good of a title to waste on a poem. So initially, the working title of this book was just Tom, you know, which isn't very catchy. And then actually, I realized that Song of the Shank, the idea of the shank, really relates to so much that happens in the novel, since obviously the word shank has so many meanings, you know.
Jeffrey Renard Allen's new novel, Song of the Shank, is published by Gray Wolf. And Jeff, it's been a great pleasure talking with you.
It's been an honor to be here. Thank you.